Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. We are segueing from last week's Skookum show with Brooke Williams, where we were saying, what if part of our opportunity responsibility as humans is to borrow qualities of intelligence and leadership, from the flora, fauna, fungi with whom we share this earth? Go, yes, fireflies can change direction in an instant. Let's do that. 360-degree vision, let's have that. So it is dark of the moon before an eclipse. Ooh, spooky time. Because remember, before an eclipse, it gets spooky, and then at an eclipse, we see, at the moment of totality, we see the stars. We see what we don't normally see. So afterwards, we can see possibilities that weren't apparent before. So the eclipse will be Saturday, March 29th at 3:58 a.m. at 9 Aries 00. So it has two sabians. One is a crystal gazer, focusing on the desirable. And the other is language crafters giving fresh expression to old symbols and animating them. This eclipse is with Venus in the underworld retrograde. She stationed at 10 Aries, descending into the underworld that wise leadership may arise in each heart dedicated to community well-being. When a complex system is far from equilibrium, small islands of coherence in a sea of chaos have the capacity to shift the entire system to a higher order. Let us be small islands of coherence in a sea of chaos. That's a quote from Ilya Prigodini. Pluto is setting in the west now, stationing at 3 Aquarius, restoring a lost condition of reverent ingenuity to culture. Janine Benyus spoke this morning at the Unfurling Bioneers Conference, and in honor of her ongoing, indefatigable dedication to participatory animism, we are replaying a great show that we did a long time ago. She will again be my guest April 10th. So biomimicry as the sine qua non for life on this planet, describing herself as a scientist, animist, poet. She is among my very favorite exemplars of woofy Venus leadership. Jupiter is now at 15 plus Gemini. Woman gives rousing speech on behalf of the Earth. It quintiles Mercury, that we can all have irresistible eloquence on behalf of what we love and open portals between worlds. The word cosmos literally means embroidery, implying harmonious order. I guess it's about looking at what is, admiring and learning from it. And it's also, I chime in from the margin, that our word cosmetic comes from cosmos. I mean, the Greeks said, what is the most beautiful thing in the world? Cosmos, embroidering of nature. Oh, well, we want to be more like that, so we will have cosmetics. And we go, oh. So more than perfectly, I get the great serious fun of welcoming our completely pertinent guest today, biomimicry. We welcome the return of Janine Benyus, natural sciences writer, author of biomimicry. My signed copy is from 8 years ago, but the book is a smidge older than that. She's the author of 4 books in the life sciences, including Beastly Behavior, A Watcher's Guide to How Animals Act and Why. Oh, I must get that one next. A graduate of Rutgers with degrees in forestry and writing. She lectures on science topics and lives in the mountains of western Montana, and has also been honored by Time Magazine as one of Eco Heroes, absolutely. Her website, Janine Benyus, J-A-N-I-N-E, Benyus, B-E-N-Y-U-S.com, is fabulous in the Biomimicry Guild that we will be exploring. So welcome, Janine.
Carolyn?
Yes. Yes. Yes, Caroline. But you're also coming in to present at Bioneers. Very heartening.
Yes. I can't wait to be back to the celebration.
Ah, exactly. That's right. We toil in the wilderness, and then we gather together to go, oh, it is heartening. Because, so much of what you've been dedicated to, I've taken into every, I aspire to take into every molecule. Borrowing, respect, borrowing from nature rather than stealing.
Big difference. Francis Bacon said, steal, we must steal nature's secrets, and we know where that's gotten us. So yeah, there's how you approach this work says everything. How you watch says everything about what you will find. And if you watch nature with the heart of a true student towards a mentor, rather than you know, a hunter towards a prey, you will, I think, be granted the lessons that we need at this point.
Well, yeah, intimacy. You know, it is in your book. You mentioned something that's mentioned in the Mabinogion, you know, Welsh Arthurian legends from 1500 years ago, and they said to us, they said humans will set forth on this independent, this toxic mimic, they said in their own language, of independence until there's a great crisis, you know, and then they will rejoin telepathically the community of creation. So we're there now, aren't we?
I think we really are. You know, I think you would be just so surprised at who now I go and talk about how life works. Who I'm speaking to are people who many of them have never, you know, cracked a science book or a biology book since they were in high school. It's basically the people listening to biomimicry right now are the designers, the architects, the engineers, the people who make our world, who make absolutely the fabric of everything we touch and drive, and this phone and our computers and our food system and our cities, and those people who design. Can you imagine how they feel right now about their job, especially young designers coming in and someone saying to them, okay, redesign our world. That's who wants to know how nature works, which is a good thing.
It's a great thing. It's, again, William McDonough's great, question to the audience, you know, the ship crossing the ocean, who's in charge? And everybody goes, the captain, the whatever. And he goes, no, the designer.
That's right.
And we're back to Venus again. Venus, the art form of collaborative design, is really what she's always represented. So I was noting that, you know, early in your book, Biomimicry, you talk about it's such an obvious, successful meme. You know, you couldn't imagine why isn't it more, you know, spread, and there's Velcro, you know, that is beginning. And that was 8 years ago, so maybe we want to say it has. I mean, I think the last time I saw you, you were on the green chemistry panel at Bioneers, which was so heartening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they said all poisons are design flaws.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And Caroline, so much has gone on. In the last 8 years, there are actually, it's become a design discipline, albeit small. There's a subset of designers who are looking to the natural world for ideas. And actually, at this point, products, processes, actual manifestations are coming about. You can buy solar cells that work the way leaves work. You can paint your house with a paint that cleans itself with rainwater the way lotus leaves do.
Where is that house paint?
It's a company called Sto, S-T-O. They're in Atlanta. They're a German company, but there's about 300,000 buildings in Europe that have this. And it's based on the rough nano structure that you see on leaves. They clean themselves with rainwater, of course. They don't have detergent. They don't have sandblasters. And so they've learned to have dirt, you know, gently teeter on little tiny bumps, and water balls up on the bumps and takes the dirt particles away. You know, so the next kitchen cabinets you buy, if you buy them here in North America, they'll likely have a glue that is completely non-toxic, and that we learned how to glue from the blue mussel, you know, small organism in the sea. So what's happened in the last 8 years is that more and more examples are coming out. And even more than that, people are starting to ask, people in companies and communities are starting to say, what are the larger lessons that nature can teach us about living here sanely? And those patterns, both at the small and the practical of a glue, all the way up to, well, how would nature power the city, and how would nature communicate, those sorts of larger lessons. That's the scope right now of what the field's doing.
And again, your work so lends itself, even just these small, elegant solutions that make us weep with beauty, going, oh, that for every toxic insult we humans have imposed on our home planet, there's an ingenious, reverent, collaborative solution. It's like,
oh. Of course. I mean, okay, I was listening before the show to the last show, which was talking about carcinogens, cancers, and cancer-causing toxins, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, so many of the things that are carcinogens are in our products because we want to preserve them in some way, right? We want to stabilize them, or we want to preserve them from microbes, and of course, when I look out my window, everything out there also would like to keep microbes from destroying it, you know, as long as it's alive. And so there's all kinds of preservatives going on out there, but none of them have the qualities that ours have. So people, here's an example of a product that's coming out. There's a plant called the Resurrection Plant. Have you ever heard of that?
No, but I want to.
Oh, it's very cool. It's in the Southwest, and this plant dries out completely, okay? There's a little bit of water left, hardly anything. And you and I would crisp, you know, we'd crisp up completely. Our cells would just, the sugars in our cells would just crystallize and break through our cell membranes. This plant turns absolutely gray and is crisp. And yet, when you pour water on it after months and months and months, it comes back. And what it does is it protects the most precious parts of its cells with this very special sugar called trehalose.
I'm sorry, say that again?
It's called trehalose, very special sugar that takes the place of water in its cells. So this guy named Bruce Rosner, he was an MD, and he was horrified by the fact that 50% of all vaccines do not reach their intended recipients because they need to be refrigerated. And there's a breakdown in the cold chain from the lab to the village. And he said, you know, why don't I look to the resurrection fern? And he's now mimicked that and has found a way to coat vaccines. And then you just put them in a vial of inert liquid, and they don't need refrigeration. They can sit in a doctor's bag for years. So this plant, and it's not about harvesting the plant, by the way. I mean, this is about looking at this design principle of how do you preserve, how do you replace water, and then he's able to, you know, freeze-dry these vaccines, and boom. Now, the question is, can we do that with the rest of our products? I mean, what, you know, and that's one kind of preserving mechanism in the natural world. There's so many.
And again, over and over again, we're looking at, you know, informed reverence as a change of heart, you know, as a way in which we, and as I was reading and rereading your book, because it is so useful, I know you have another one coming out in the spring that we want to address, and your great talk coming up at Bioneer is so thrilling, but rereading Biomimicry was, I was so grateful to be able to excavate it, going, oh, it is so pertinent and so fit. But because we tease it also into all the large issues. I mean, here we are, okay, the economic collapse, which, yeah, you know, our cells all knew, unstable system, you know, ripe for evolutionary dramatic change. But also, you know, your work so lends itself to tease into every kind of aspect of life. It's about real, a democratic heart, you know, a democracy dedicated heart over colonialism. I mean, really a kind of attitude of pillage and plunder, which you say is heat, beat, and treat technology, you know, and poisonous, and, you know, ripping up and destroying and mocking. You know, we are, you know, hubris, really. I like to say, you know, may the guidance of animism eclipse the hubris of, you know, of humanism. You know, humans as the measure of all things, going, because clearly you have an animist's heart, don't you?
Mm-hmm. I mean, oh yeah. I mean, I'm every inch a scientist and every inch a poet, and
yes,
hopefully, I mean, my heart is, and I think they can coexist in the same. In fact, I think, you know, and Rachel Carson taught me this, that you've got to bring the ecstatic into science writing.
Yeah.
I mean, because the world is ecstatic. It's absolutely, you know, it's that amazing. And here's the other thing. You do not have to, I mean, it's the truth, the absolute scientific rigorous, you know, like describing it exactly as it is the most amazing, you know, and we try to get closer and closer to that. But the truth of what I talk about these organisms, it's, I mean, you could never make this up. I have one. You talked about democracy.
Yeah.
I have one for you. This is really interesting. I just learned this. Do you know how bees vote?
Oh, I want to know. I want to know.
About this.
Yeah.
Okay. Bees vote in a way that is informing. There's actually a movement to try to get this kind of voting. It's called range voting. And because it may be more fair and it may be more accurate, it may give us the candidates we actually want. What they do is every year they split the members of their hive and they half of them fly off. It can be up to like 20,000 bees will fly off and they have to find a new place to do their hive. So they have to choose, and they choose among maybe 20 different hive sites, and they all have to, and they all choose as a hive where to go. Okay? So what happens is they send out 5% of their scouts at first. And these are the scouts, these are the bees that have proven very, very good at foraging. And I guess everybody knows that. They're really good. They can find stuff. So they go out and they start to look around. They'll go to a hollow tree and they'll spend up to an hour investigating.
Whoa.
Each of them. Okay? And they're out there and they're investigating. And then they come back and they start to dance. They do their waggle dance. And they dance the longest and the hardest for the ones that, the most vigorously, for the ones they really, really like.
Oh, I love that.
And so what, and then the other bees all watch. And the ones that are dancing most vigorously and longest, they go, the other bees go, wow, we should go check that out. So a few of them will go and check out, because they're also doing direction, right? They're also telling you with the dance where
right,
to go.
Right.
So more bees go out, and then they come back, and the ones that have checked it out come back, and they start dancing for it. And they go, this is really fabulous, you know? And next thing you know, more and more bees are voting for the one that, you know, but it takes a long time. It can take up to 2 weeks.
Mm.
They'll dance for hours and hours. And it's, and range voting is what happens at the Olympics. You know, when you basically you have all these judges and they give a they say, you know, this person gets an 8 and this person gets a 9. They say exactly, they vote for every, say we had 10 candidates instead of 2. We would vote for every single one, but we would say on a range of 0 to 9, this one's a 9, this one's a 3, this one's a 4. And it turns out that when you do that, they've run simulations. First of all, entomologists say that bees find what they consider the best nest sites 90% of the time. 90% of what they choose is like, from the entomologist's point of view, that is the best one. So it's an amazing system that they've come up with, but they've been at it 50 million years. They figure they've had trillions of elections, so they've tried different ways of voting. And this one, and when you simulate humans doing having 10 candidates and voting the way we vote now, which is plurality voting, you know, first one to the post wins. We only pick the right one 39% of the time. So it's 90% of the time they're picking the quality nest site. These sorts of things blow your mind.
Oh, I love that. I love that, because that's also where we get our word inauguration from. Well, it's from the augur. And it was the human, I guess, you know, in a sense, the human who was the scout, like a bee, the augur, would go out and would study, investigate nature's patterns, and by that, nature would reveal who the most responsible human steward was, and then they would be inaugurated.
Oh, interesting.
Isn't that great? No, but now I'm going for the bees voting. This is so great. So also we have to then say, you know, well, how are the bees doing now? I mean, are they able to vote? How?
Well, they're collapsing. Colony collapse disorder, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, there's that, and that is, oh my gosh, that's incredibly heartbreaking. And
also, we need to learn how to vote like the bees before our arrogance destroys the bees who know how to vote.
Exactly. Exactly.
So it's neck and neck now, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's so much poignancy.
Yeah, there really is.
And
it is. It's trembling. Everybody's trembling right now. I'm feeling.
Well, so we do want, you know, I want to honor also your four steps, you know, for quieting and listening and interviewing and all those at the end of your book, but to dance back and forth, you know, there is that wonderful Wendell Berry poem, you know, when fear for the world is too much with me, excuse me, Wendell, for paraphrasing, you know, I go and lay down with the woodrake, with the animals who do not burden themselves with forethought of grief, and for a time my heart is at peace.
Mm.
But I love that poem, but I'm also, invite you. But I'm a little concerned now that animals actually are burdened with forethought of grief. That they sense that something's wrong. I don't know. Can we still use that poem? You know, is there a forethought of a sense of telepathic systems distress?
Are they absolutely? I think the natural world has its ears completely pricked, and they are on the move, Caroline. I mean, organisms, we've had some meta studies now, which are studies of studies, and people have looked at thousands of individual studies, right, to ascertain a pattern, and they've looked at movement of organisms, and this is plants, animals, fungi, many organisms, and they are moving from south to north. You can imagine being in space and looking down at the Earth and imagine the movement from south to north in North America here or in the Northern Hemisphere in order to go from, you know, they're escaping the heat, or to go from the top of mountains down. So they're lowering. And when I say they're moving, their ranges, their whole species ranges are moving. And so what's happening, so they're aware. They are completely aware
and
responding already.
So do you think, in a sense, that grief, forethought of grief, is a human indulgence, and they're just alert and responding as ingeniously and creatively as possible with no time for grief? I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you, when they move, they get to completely new places, all right? And say you're a bee, and your species moves north. And you get there, and the plant that you normally pollinate has already flowered. Or, you know, there's all these, like, and believe me, when they get there, there may not be forethought of grief, but when they get there, there's a lot of grief and a lot of survival yikes going on. I mean, it's as if you've, you know, tilted the Earth and species are sliding into each other and colliding, and predator and prey who have never met before, and all of that incredible sort of negotiation that's been worked out, ecological negotiation that's been worked out, you know, like,
yeah,
okay,
right.
You know, you come during the day, I'll come back and feed at night. You take the top of that canopy, I'll do the bottom. All of that works out over, you know, millennia, totally disrupted now because it's all new members. So they're knitting together societies in whole new ways. That's got it. I mean, there's got to be a pulse of just confusion and, now what? As things shake out again.
But of course, you know, again, you know, chiming in with our human, man-made imposed crisis, you know, unstable system invites change, you mentioned over and over again, and then leaping to a whole new level of creativity after crisis, you know, we reach limits and then ingenuity. So it's more than perfect that, you know, for reasons of what we as a rude species have set in motion, we're all going to have to cooperate more. Going, feed you this, okay, that, again, work of Paul Stamets with the fungi going, the fungi are working on it, you know, they're trying to heal us. They're working on metabolizing the poison, even radioactivity. They've never done it before, but they're willing to try, is the way he puts it.
Yeah.
And so there's all this, yes, grief and ingenuity, you know, grief is the bouncing off place, in a sense, going, all right, ingenuity. So we want to join that, you know, creative frequency, going, oh, we're very sorry, and now we're willing to, you know, to be ingenious and collaborate and create. Because one of the things I was so impressed by, also, the green chemistry panel you were on, is all these, you know, very grown-up, power-possessing, you know, guys were, you know, said you'd change their mind, you know, these were influential humans who had been, I've forgotten, I apologize, but they were, you know, they'd been heads of agencies.
Paul Anastas, yeah.
Yes, right.
And Terry Collins, yeah. Green Chemistry Institute. Is the world taking this seriously now? You have no idea. Yeah. I mean, people are, and it's innovation is absolutely right. At any time, you know, bacteria that are under stress, they increase their rate of adaptation, you know. And the best way to increase your rate of innovation is to get into a co-evolutionary loop with another organism, by the way. But innovation, you know, life's really good. Life's got a good innovation system, right? It's called natural selection. So it's this fabulous sort of mutation, and then either mutation or mixing of half of the DNA of one organism and half of the ideas of another, and they get put together, and that reshuffling is a great way to innovate, right? But then innovation isn't enough, because innovation is part of it. Natural selection is variation and then selection. So you get the variation, and then all these wild ideas, and then life has a really coherent selection process. And that's such a mature place for us to be. We're good at innovating.
Right.
And now when all these, and this is what's happening, all these new ideas are popping up. I mean, it's astounding. And we have to look and go, there's a good one. Yep, there's a good one. And we have to be willing to say, oh, made a mistake. That's not as good as I thought, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of constant selection. But what's the criteria? So in the natural world, the selection criteria is what's good for life, what's good for living tissues. That wins.
And also, you know, as William Morris said, you know, let us have only those things in our homes that we know to be useful and believe to be beautiful.
Mm.
So that, I think that's the four steps. Is it beautiful? You know, is it beautiful, beautiful and useful? So,
well, beauty was once the signal of the good.
Yes.
Right? So for 99% of the time we've been on Earth, we were hunters and gatherers. And evolutionary psychologists are saying that the reason, they guess the reason we love flowers and are drawn to flowers is because, or one of the reasons, is because what it meant was 2 weeks later there would be food, you know?
Mm.
And we love sparkling water because it's fresh and oxygenated, not stagnant. You know, and we love, you know, there's these patterns that we grew to love and we found beautiful, but they were coupled to what was good.
Right.
And so now when you clutch something that you love, I mean, I love my little technological gadgets as much as anyone, you know, you clutch those to your breast kind of thing. And they're beautiful. They're beautifully designed. But are they fully good? So recoupling the beautiful with the good, meaning good for life, is the designer's quest.
Yes, that's so perfect. Our guest today is Janine Benyus. Her website is janinebenyus.com, JanineBenyus. And we're going to take a very short break. You can join us after break if you are inadvertently or vertently patient by calling 510-848-4425, because there's so much we want to put on our our altar of dedication. We know that, you know, the antidote to fear is deeper dedication, and we will be right back.
She shook the consolation and dazzled them crossed his eyes. She shook the constellation and dazzled them crossed his eyes. She showered his head with quasar and made his tortoise cry.
Get down.
Shiny, 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 come blow my shiny horn.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, where we are, you know, may informed reverence for life be our new default setting of how we engage with each other and each other on out into all our relations, absolutely. Our guest today is Janine Benyus. She will be presenting at the Bioneers Conference on Saturday morning in the plenary. Ooh, so good. And I will finish the evening or the day Saturday night at the Veterans Auditorium as well with Restoring the Waters of Life to Democracy. Janine's work is so informative. What a great ally, because for everything is real and everything's symbolic, so it has so informed my work. When you were talking, Janine, about, yes, innovation and limits and discernment. Well, just the planetary pattern now on November 4th is Saturn in Virgo is limitation, editing, precision, dedication, informed reverence, opposite Uranus, which is wildness and innovation. We go, so we're voting for more than humans. You know, we're like, oh. So my love, of course, is the tricksters and the trickster ingenious animals. So, you know, when you're saying innovation, you know, is a co-evolutionary loop. So I saw this film of crows, you know, who are so calmly adopting. It showed crows in the middle of downtown Tokyo, and they dropped nuts into this incredible, you know, unbelievable traffic system, and then they waited on the sidewalk until the pedestrian light flashed, and then they walked calmly out into the street and picked up their nuts that industrialism had crushed for them. And it's so moving to see it, because they, even if there's no humans there, they patiently wait. Even if there's no traffic there, they patiently wait until the little flashing pedestrian sign goes, oh, God, they're smart.
They're really smart.
And then they had this thing, which I'm not sure, I want to run this by you, I'm not sure I approve of it, but it is kind of interesting. It's a film, you know, taken in which they have a machine that if you put if a crow puts a coin in it, it delivers peanuts. And so the crows quickly learn to take the coins and put it in the machine, and then they get a peanut. And then one day, there are no coins there. So the crows go out into the world, and they bring back the coins and drop them in the machine and get the peanuts. And the scientist was saying, you know, well, we could train them to pick up garbage, you know, or anything. And it's like, yeah, I'm not sure about the morality, you know, employing, you know, but interesting.
It's interesting how we see something amazing in the natural world, and we say, how can I get them to do that for me?
I know. See, that's where I back off. It's like I was happier seeing the crows dropping the nuts in traffic than I was about, you know, training them to work for a living.
Yeah, or like, actually, yeah, like dolphins with bombs strapped to them.
Oh!
You know, go to that sub.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, that's the gulf we have to cross. Because
yes.
I do this in my work all the time. I bring people to this level of absolute amazement with the natural world. And there's a, you know, like, for instance, we'll bring designers, engineers from all these companies together to Costa Rica for a week. And we'll say, here you are. Here's the models of, you know, I mean, you couldn't get it any better than this. All the models in a system go. Design. And at first, you know, the old reflex is, oh, my gosh, you know, gold rush.
Right.
And
colonialism again.
Yeah, and then the longer that they're there, and again, if you get into a mentor relationship with an organism,
right,
it curbs that. It's as if that young, you know, you don't make that young mistake often, because what happens is these people they go to the organism and they say, oh, I see how you're doing that. I'm going to go do it. And they go and they try, and they don't know how to do it. So they have to go back to the organism. I mean, you look at the people who have studied photosynthesis for years and gone back and said, could you tell me again how that works? And each time you go back, you go, oh, my goodness, you know, I have about 10% of this that I really even think I even know, and there's so much more. So there is a reverence that develops.
Yes, I see.
Which is what's transformative about the process. There, of course, there's always the potential for the gold rush, but something about this process really makes it, you have to go through the questioning of the organism. It takes time. You can't just take out a chainsaw, chop it down, and go and pull it behind you. That's not what it's about.
No, like John McCain's metaphor of, we're just going to take a chainsaw to spending.
The hatchet.
Everything is trying to speak to us, including the cartoon of this election. It's like, you know, when you talk about the beautiful as opposed to what humans mistake for the beautiful, I use over and over again that the word glamour is a Scottish word, glamour, and it's not a good thing. It's men's fear of powerful women projected onto a dangerous, seductive woman who lures men onto the rocks. That's what glamour means, as opposed to beauty. And the monstrous feminine mythology, the monstrous masculine is usually not too subtle. It's like, chainsaw, McChaney, blah, blah, blah. The monstrous feminine is usually glamorous, beguiling. I'll beguile you. No, I will. You know, and so we have the beguiling VP, you know, glamour, not beauty. So it's kind of a perfect...
It is almost, you know, you couldn't write the Shakespearean play any better than this.
No, everything's really trying to help us. I mean, everything is trying to help us. It's like if we just, again, were willing to wake up as well. And so mutual aid, you know, what you say, developing reverence.
Yeah.
And so one of the thing is it you know, a reciprocal blessing? You know, is that one of our criterion that you're kind of put forth? Is it good for everybody?
Well, I'll tell you, the reciprocal blessing is more for me. I've gotten to the point where the platitude of that is not enough.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And so this field has gotten large enough that it became obvious about 3 years ago to me that there needed to be a Thanksgiving loop. There needed to be a way that we put tobacco at the corners of our teepees, you know,
right,
to say, wow, loved that meal, thanks a lot, you know, like the thank you. And so we started a couple of years ago, since you and I have spoken, we started the Biomimicry Institute, which is our nonprofit. And one of the main things is a program called Innovation for Conservation. And we're asking the companies that are in this work to donate a percentage of their proceeds to conserve the habitat of the organism that inspired them.
Yeah.
Say thank you, you know? Say thank you and realize this was not my idea. And if I benefit from this idea, and I think we will. I think these companies will be profitable, but I also think we'll all benefit in that they're more sustainable ideas. But nevertheless, you could quickly get to the point where, gee, you forgot it wasn't your idea. In fact, I've seen it happen. There's a group that did work with dolphins, and they learned from dolphins how to send messages underwater, and then created this underwater modem system that will now tell us when tsunamis are going to hit. It's based on the dolphin chirps. And I watched for years as this scientist, who was a dolphin researcher, published all these papers, and then there was a patent, and in his case, all of a sudden, boy, there were no mention of the dolphins anymore. Now, that's a very rare. Most people really do say, this is where I got this idea, and it's very cool. But, you know, so there's a, how do we, as a culture, say, let's institute a way to say thanks?
And again, fairy tales and legends are so pitching to us that crucial principle you just put on our work table. In the Arthurian legends, Sir Balin and Sir Balan are given magical powers and a magic sword from the fairy realm. And when their contribution to the community is over, the fairies say, now, you know, pay us homage and give it back. And they say, no, it is ours. And they go, well, then you will destroy the world and you will kill what you most love. And, and they do. You know, so again, it's built into our mythic DNA, you know, that we want to kind of revitalize. And that's why your work is so useful. To me, I think of myself as a mythological cultural strategist, but it's like, oh, it's there. You know, everything you say, I go, oh, it's there.
Well, whenever I talk to you, when I'm walking through this, it feels very pedestrian to me. You know, it's like, yes, this is the way. I forget that, of course, I'm being animated by myth. Of course, I realize the storyline, you know, somewhere deep, but not on a conscious level. That's what's wonderful about you, is that you remind us that this has gone on before, that we're part of this huge Paget River flow, and, you know, and hopefully we're in the right stream, you know. I feel like I am, in that I've been helped by invisible hands, countless invisible hands and
right.
feathers and flippers. You know, I really have, in a way that, you know, my father keeps saying, you've got to map this. You've got to, you know, map all the relationships and how, you know, the first Paul Hawken holding the book up and then, you know, how this book has sort of moved into the world, not by my power whatsoever, but by the pulled into the world.
Well, it is call and response. It wants to happen. And I love the pagan chant, fur and feather and scale and skin, different without, but the same within. You know, from all creatures are the gods made whole. We go, oh, yes, yes, yes. We have patient callers waiting, but there's so much I also want to put on our table. But let's go to our first really patient caller, Carrie from Sebastopol. Come in.
Two really quick things. First of all, is nutritionally some stuff that I've run across over the years about our cravings for sugar and how in the natural world, how that naturally occurs. There's certain minerals that are naturally there, and we've gone the route of denaturing it and removing the sugar because, gee, the sugar tastes really good, and we don't really like the color of all that other stuff.
Oh, but that was the bait for us originally. It was the pleasure principle, was so we could get the other stuff.
So that's what we wanted.
Yeah, that's what our bodies needed.
But the second thing is something I ran across in the news just recently, that they're starting to see infestations in the Southwest as the military folks are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan of these gigantic cockroaches that are from the Middle East, the Madagascar hissing cockroach.
Oh, you're kidding. What we had in school, remember those that you had, at least I did in my biology classes. Huh.
Yeah, these huge, ginormous things. And I'm thinking, so did we just go to war just because we needed to have a transportation system for these guys?
Yes, the cockroaches did it, right.
what exactly is going on with that, and what are we here to learn from it?
Hmm.
Yes, intriguing. Thank you. Good, intriguing offerings, Gary.
Huh. You know, this movement, I was just reading about Hawaii this morning and Hawaii ecology.
Ah, yeah.
And it's 2 million times faster. We're moving organisms into Hawaii, into the islands, 2 million times faster than they would normally get there.
Hmm.
You know, it just took forever for organisms to get there because they're so far away from any landmass. So you really had to, you know, work it. You had to, like, fly in on a current or float in and make it in the salt water. And so, organisms would sort of, you know, drop pooped and exhausted into the Hawaiian Islands. And now, of course, we carry them in everything we bring in. So the invasive species thing is really... It is part of our niche right now. It's part of what we do in the world, is move other organisms around.
Yes, and I did like the contrarian or complexity. We want voluntary complexity of botanist Stephen Buhner, who said some of the invasive plant species are, you know, it's a difficult imposition, rude, you know, whatever. He said, but some are showing up to heal us. He said, I can walk around somebody's house and see what is categorized as an invasive weed species around their house and diagnose the illness of the people inside because the weeds are showing up to heal them. I love this idea, you know, as though all of nature is saying we got to either kill the humans or heal them or we're all going down. Let's try healing them first, you know. So, So there may be, well, we have to cooperate with everything. I mean, it is speeded up, but we have to cooperate, although E.O. Wilson does say that there is no indigenous Hawaiian ecological system left.
Yeah, it's really a, I'll tell you, some of the, you talk about grief, island ecologists.
Yeah.
Seriously, island ecologists, we should all be sending them, you know, packages of love, because they watch this, you know, this really fragile, these fragile systems, get taken apart. I just got back from New Zealand where, you know, the opossum, there's 70 million opossums and they eat a lot of vegetation all night long. And, you know, it's just, yeah. So, that movement is, you know, obviously people are trying to slow that down as well.
Just to tease into politics, you know, I do find that John McCain's campaign manager, Rick Davis, looks really quite almost exactly to the invasive snakefish that's in the East Coast that is this monster fish that can, you know, get out of the water and travel across land and eat everything. And it looks really just exactly like Rick Davis. So it's like, oh, invasive snakefish campaign manager.
Do you know the difference between invasives and naturalized species?
Ah, please guide me.
That's a really interesting one. Because in our work early on as a bunch of biologists, realizing that biomimicry, learning from nature, was a meme, right? Was a cultural meme. So we thought, well, we would like to help spread this cultural meme, but how shall we learn from nature about how to do this? Now, invasive species are those that come in and that have, they basically do not have a beneficial, net beneficial effect.
Right.
But there are others that come in that are alien, but that get naturalized. And what that means is that they wind up being welcome in the ecosystem. It's
right.
Like, glad you're here. This is good. You're contributing in this way and this way and this way. Boy, you know, this works. And I mean, I think, and so we said to ourselves, well, let's be the naturalized species. Let's do that instead. And there are people who study those two systems. And what are their characteristics, you know? It's a good model, the naturalized.
It is a good model. And I want to ask you about the underworld and roots, and also the thing you told me 8 years ago that I want, you know, the positive hierarchy. You know, we go hierarchy bad, not democratic, but you were so good at that. But let me invite in our next patient caller, Emma in Fresno. Emma, welcome.
Hi. I am 67 and a half years old. And I have been very, very sick. Now I'm better. But my allies are so tiny. I mean, my first ally as a child was a colony of red ants in Van Nuys, California. And they've gotten progressively smaller and smaller until we're down to Harry the microbe. And I'm lonely. I want bigger allies.
that's a wonderfully poetic offering, Emma. Bigger allies, although, again, you know, remember E.O. Wilson says that his favorite, you know, he's rooting for the bacteria, and the ants are his favorite thing in the world. He loves those ants. Each person has an assignment. I often think that people want, you know, glamorous power animals going, no, your power animal is the cockroach, and, you know, and your power this or that. But, yeah, the beautiful, not necessarily the glamorous. But do you have a response, Janine, to Emma's loneliness at the little?
Oh, my gosh. Well, most of your body is microbes.
Yeah, we want to be on
not
good terms.
Just the bad ones. I mean, we're a colony. Our whole body is a colony. Most, you know, the biggest weight, most of our weight is other organisms that are in and on our skin and in our bodies, doing many of them doing their level best to keep this organism afloat. You know, let me tell you about Delicia pulchra. It's a seaweed off the coast of Botany Bay, Australia. And it is completely turned on our heads, our idea of how to fight microbes.
And can you say its name again?
Delicia pulchra.
Delicia.
It means delicate beauty.
Yes, pulchra.
It's a red algae, and Peter Steinberg, a marine biologist, noticed that in Botany Bay, there was all kinds of slimy biofilms festooning everything, except for this one plant. This plant was just shining, literally shining in the sea. And he was diving and went, what is that? And why doesn't it have... The slime is bacteria that go in biofilms. What they do is they get together. It's called quorum sensing. They get together. They land. A couple of bacteria will land on a surface, and then they'll start to communicate to other bacteria passing by. And then they'll come along, and they'll land. And when there's a quorum, when they sense a quorum, they'll begin to put out sugars, form a slimy layer, and that's when you're in a hospital, you've heard of superbugs. They get into biofilms. That's when they turn on their toxins, and that's when we douse them with poisons. And then the ones that live are the ones that become the superbugs, okay? So we kill them, and that breeds for resistance. But what this algae does is it releases a little molecule called a furanone into the water. It floats up, and it jams the communication network. It literally sits in the receptors and jams the ears, so to speak, of the bacteria passing by. So they can't hear the call to come on down. And they keep passing by. And the ones that have landed on the surface give up and go, there's no party here, and they leave.
Oh.
This is amazing because it's repelling bacteria rather than killing them, so it doesn't breed for resistance. And there's a company called Biosignal that I think is a very powerful technology in that we're mimicking this new way of repelling locally and temporarily. As the bacteria pass by, once they get far enough away, the furanones fall out and they go about their business.
I love that.
It's and so we're talking about very elegant ways now of dealing with bacteria, and we're just beginning to realize. Here's another one. There's a plant called the barberry, and it has an antibacterial, but it's very, very weak, material called berbene. But what it does is it has a synergistic effect. It has berbene, and berbene will go into bacteria. But the bacteria very quickly start to pump out the berbene. They have these pumps, these little holes in their cell membranes that pump out. It's like, whoa, this isn't good for me, and they pump it out. The plant, the barberry plant, puts another chemical out that plugs the pump. And then the very mild antibacterial eventually will kill the bacteria.
Hmm.
But it's the two things combined, and it's not this
overkill.
Exactly. So there's, you know.
Well, it's again everything real, everything symbolic. It's diplomacy, not warfare, or ingenuity, or luring something to contain its own harmfulness. Love that.
Really interesting.
Really interesting. Well, let's go to our next really patient caller with a beautiful name, Khalid in Berkeley. Come in, Khalid.
Diplomacy, not warfare or ingenuity.
You have to turn your radio down, Khalid.
Yes.
Yes. Welcome.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm Khalid. I'm originally from Yemen. I'm a beekeeper in Berkeley for a while. And I've been listening to bacteria. Since I know about a little bit about honey, honey actually kills the bacteria, especially darker honey, because honey comes as it has no oxygen. Scientifically, it's been proved that honey doesn't have oxygen, and it contains hydrogen peroxide. So the bacteria cannot survive in an environment that doesn't have oxygen and it's loaded with the hydrogen peroxide.
There you go.
Yeah, we go back to basic, and a human being can treat himself with the basic things. It started with the childhood when the baby born, taking the breastfeed milk, for 2 years. That's a natural antibiotic. It builds your immune system. When you grow older, you're never going to get that sickness like a person who would take that formula. You're going to be well-resistant to fight those bacteria and illnesses. And how you maintain your health, meaning staying away from junk, sugar, stuff, eating healthy, especially with honey. A lot of cultures, if you just maintain yourself and stay away from sugar and eat a lot of honey, you'll be healthy for a long time, hardly catching cold.
Wonderful. Thank you, Khalid. There's a beautiful symmetry. We begin with bee voting, and we come around to Khalid and his sacred stewardship of the bees from Yemen. The positive, yes, the welcome from Yemen as opposed to the giant, we go, yes, the wonderful transfer across borders and the bees. Yeah. That's really great. Okay, we're winding down. There's so many things, but you are here on the planet forever, so that's good. We have one more caller. I guess we will go there, and then we'll see if we can do the underworld and Pluto in a moment. Okay, Jonathan in Berkeley, come in very succinctly.
Okay, I wanted to ask a question about the connection between bird language and the human acquisition of language.
Mm.
If you're familiar with John Young, who, you know, has kind of synthesized native cultures around the globe into five distinct voices of the birds, such as alarm calls, companion calls, territoriality, etc. And so, you know, these native societies have learned this language in order to be able to be, you know, to know what's going on in the forest and the jungle. But my question is, was it actually the other way around? That is it possible that humans acquired language by observing bird language?
Mm. You know, David Abrams thinks so, and many people now are thinking that perhaps we sang before we talked.
Oh, I love that.
Mm.
Dancing and singing, more of this, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think The Spell of the Sensuous, David Abrams' book, you know, talks about the fact that, of course, we were around, you know, vocal organisms, and we mimicked them. Of course.
Yeah,
of course,
and wolves.
We did.
And we learned so much from wolves about community and hunting together, too.
Exactly. Of course we did. And back to that, you know, back to the crow and what the crow might teach us.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's something there. I think I can see us singing before we talked.
I vote for that. It's right. It's mythologically true for sure. I mean, because it clicks into our DNA. Thank you so much for your work, Janine.
Oh, thank you, Carolyn.
Wonderful. And we will reconvene next week. Thanks, everyone.
Okay.